Welcome to the Religious Studies Project once again. I'm David Robertson.
He's Christopher Cotter. And we are presented
in association with the BASR, the British Association for the Study of Religions.
We've got another returning interviewee for you this week. We've got quite a few recently. This is A. David Lewis being interviewed by Dave McConaughey, who hasn't done an interview for us for a while. So great to have him back. And what's the interview on, David?
I'm just laughing at the number of Daves and Davids and a David involved in this interview. The subject is afterlife in comic books. But by the end, we'll be able to talk about, you know, how much this actually encompasses. But afterlife in comic books, take it away.
Today, I am joined here at the Religious Studies Project with the fabulous A. David Lewis.
Oh, who fabulous.
Fabulous. He is the Faculty Associate of Humanities at the Massachusetts College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, where he teaches literature and comparative literature and world religions and pop culture. And he is also a man who wears many hats as a series editor with the new Palgrave Pivot series. He is soliciting and editing works on contemporary religion and popular religion. He is also the co-chair at the American Academy of Religion of the Death, Dying, and there's one more there.
Beyond. It's a, and it's also contemporary religion and popular culture.
I think popular culture, yes.
Okay.
At Palgrave, yes. Yeah. And he is also one of the founders of an emerging group called Sacred and Sequential that is focusing on the intersection of religion and comic books. And he is a columnist for Duke University's Islamic Commentary. That is an online publication that he writes for monthly. So, with all of his fingers in these many pies, it's easy to forget that he also now has been involved in publication of three quite excellent academic volumes and his own graphic novel.
So thank you. Yeah.
We can introduce some of those things real quickly here. For those of you who haven't had a chance to pop into the graphic novel world, we can look at The Lone and Level Sands, all about Pharaoh Ramses and his lost cousin Moses. If that piques your interest and you'd like a little bit more academic taste of the religion and comics world, you could head over to the edited volume Graven Images, which discusses religion in comic books and graphic novels. That volume has been featured in a previous Religious Studies podcast. And
it was co-edited by Christine Hoff-Kramer as well. I can't take credit for it solo. There were a lot of contributors in on that.
And the really nice thing about that volume is how widely the various contributors really looked at all of the different kind of various comic books that you want, from superheroes to non-superhero elements. The whole gamut is right there.
Yeah, thank you.
Following up with his another co-edited volume with Christopher Moorman, on digital death, mortality, and beyond in the online age. So if you're interested in the intersection of death and dying and what happens when you put it online, then that is the volume for you. And then finally, just released yesterday and today, American Comics, Literary Theory and Religion, The Superhero Afterlife with Palgrave Macmillan. And that volume is large and in charge. You were nice enough
I want to read that. That sounds really good.
You were nice enough to provide me of a copy of it so that we would have a chance to kind of talk about the intersection of comics and the afterlife, which is really something that I had never really considered before. In part, I think my personal preference as a comics reader has my characters always going to hell. And always coming back. So Hellboy, for instance, John Constantine, the Hellblazer, and then most recently the still ongoing and very brand new Devilers by Faklov, who's out here in California. So all of those involve people that routinely go to hell. But that's not quite what you're talking about when you talk about the kind of superhero afterlife experience, is it?
It's part of it, but it's only part of it. You're right. I think if we were actually trying to assemble a list of characters, of superhero characters, the superhero genre in particular, who haven't had an afterlife experience, it would be a very short list. It would be a surprisingly short list.
Can you name one off the top of your head?
I don't know if Robin the... No, I take that back. I was going to say Robin the Boy Wonder. He definitely died and came back.
So it's a struggle, right? To even name one.
It's a big struggle. Let's see here. The Wasp. Okay. Janet Pym the Wasp. Wait. I don't even know that she is... Yeah, has she ever been to hell or heaven or...
Are we in the second or the third tier of comic superheroes when we talk about the Wasp today?
Yeah, you have to go deep. And that, the recurrence of this setting, of this storyline, is what started to get my attention after a while. I mean, I think I said in another interview at the Broken Frontier website that... if left ignored for too long, right, this recurring habit could actually start to get embarrassing for comics, right? It could be a well they went to too many times, the way we look at the Silver Age comics and how often they included monkeys and gorillas.
Right.
But instead of being embarrassed by it, I decided to take it kind of head on and look at what could the cultural significance of this recurrent story be? What could the literary significance of this story be? And given the field that I'm in now, is there a religious significance to it? This is practically by definition a religious scene. The afterlife, that which cannot be explained by science and physics and astronauts and so forth alone. So I decided to go the other way with it. Rather than deny it and try to not look at it, that's really where my doctoral work went down the rabbit hole with this. And it led me to some surprising results, some surprising conclusions.
Do you think that the ubiquity of the theme has strengthened the elements of the trope? Because in the work that I've read, it seems for you that it really solidified the kind of major elements of it, so that you could make a typology of what happens. There is a narrative. The narrative has these like pretty discrete components.
Yeah.
That seem to, if they're not written down somewhere at DC and Marvel, right? At least the writers seem to implicitly know an afterlife journey takes these things. So I can see, like, when you went down the literary rabbit hole, not only did you take quite a lot of the theory, which I was perhaps it over my head in slightly with the literary theory going on, which I do want to talk about, consciousness and subjectivity and what it means when we show the multiplicity of the self that arises in the afterlife. But when we're looking at the kind of arc of your scholarship, I think the literary theory elements, right, they really come forward because you treated this as a subgenre of a genre.
And it qualifies. I mean, that's kind of the issue. We use genre as a word very loosely, right?
Yes, we do.
But there's actual, if you're coming from a formalist tradition, actual formal requirements for what you need for a genre. And there's a whole subspecialty of genre studies that I try to immerse myself in. Genre studies aren't entirely disconnected from religious studies either. Mm-hmm. You have the genre of the gospel story or the genre of the confessional, the genre of the saint's biography. So I tried to use genre theory and genre studies to look at, do we have a legitimate, by definition of the theory, do we have a legitimate subgenre here? And the conclusion I came to was yes, that if superheroes are a genre, and I think we can really easily make the argument that they are, there have been numerous books out on that. Peter Coogan's comes to mind most readily. Superhero, yeah, and there's What is a Superhero, right, which he co-edited as well. And he also has Superhero, The Secret Origin of a Genre. You could then take all these many afterlife stories starring superheroes and start to gel together a set of, I believe, six formal elements. And here we go off the top of my head. The six elements are... So they're not willy-nilly, right? Just writers are just throwing superheroes into the afterlife whenever there's an issue that they want to do this. Somehow, whether it's from feedback from their audience or it's from some internal mechanism, instinct, sense of how the narrative works, six elements have come to the forefront, and they are. The afterlife has to take place in an alternate dimension. Heaven is not here on Earth, right?
Yeah.
Secondly, there has to be an encounter with a family member or a familial encounter with someone that is like family. I'm going out of order, yes. But just throw them out there as they occur to me. There has to be a liberated character. There has to be some character that escapes the afterlife, which creates its own problems, frankly. And we can get to that later. But if you have an eternal afterlife, particularly one of reward, if we're talking about a heavenly one, a paradisal one, or one of the garden, isn't it weird to spring someone out of there? But it's very much a superhero trope to do so. So I was up to three. A fourth one, there has to be an Alistair. There has to be an opponent. This doesn't have to be an evil or infernal opponent necessarily, but it does have to be some sort of guardian or situational antagonist that comes into play. Five, there has to be a dream state or set of hallucinations that make the afterlife reality feel more real. That is to say that someone wakes up from a dream, breaks out of a hallucination, and finds themselves in an even more real afterlife. And finally, the sixth one, not finally in order, but the one I haven't mentioned yet, is the heroic reversal. Someone has to act out of character. A hero has to prove villainous. A villain has to prove heroic. And I particularly like this one because it emphasizes that the afterlife setting is not your typical setting. It's not like going from Gotham to Metropolis. It's not like going from Guardians of the Galaxy, Kree planet out there to fighting crime in New York City. They all operate by supposedly the same physics and perhaps the same moral universe. That shouldn't be so with an afterlife setting where concerns, where mortal concerns are supposed to drizzle away, right? There's supposed to be a new sense of cosmology. Normal life drizzle away.
Yeah.
And you have characters who, while they were alive, while they were corporeal, had particular concerns. What does it mean to save the day in the afterlife? Or what does it mean to rule the world in the afterlife? So this heroic reversal, whether it's villain to hero, hero to villain, proves to be very important. These six kept showing up over and over. Nearly every story that I read, and I read a bunch in a 25-year period, had at least four of the six elements, if not all six. What proved particularly interesting to me, which cohered nicely to genre studies, is no one demanded these elements, right? There was no editor with a list somewhere saying, you got to hit this one, and this one. And there was no audience saying we must have the following in our afterlife stories. And yet there was an audience and a community understanding, a reciprocal process, a cyclical process by which these afterlife stories took on formal elements.
Can you give us a pretty good example of like some famous afterlife story that is perhaps your favorite or example used in the book? What's one that we can grasp onto as a narrative here?
I write a whole chapter about the Fantastic Four, about a storyline written by Mark Waid with art by Mike Ringo, Wherein, so of the four Fantastic Four characters, Mr. Fantastic and the Invisible Woman and the Human Torch and the Thing and Ben Grimm the Thing. Well, the Thing has died. The Thing was accidentally killed during one of their adventures. And rather than accept that, mourn, grieve, and move on, Mr. Fantastic, with his super mind, super genius, says, we're going to go get him back from the afterlife. It is not right that he died. And so, using super technology, he does go through the first element. He does pierce into the alternate dimension that they take to be heaven. And as it turns out, they are there and find that they are opposed. They have an Alistair. They don't know who it is quite yet, but they do know that their quest to find Ben, to find the Thing, is being prevented. Now here's the tricky part. They run into Sue Storm or Sue Richards or Johnny Storm's parents, either as a hallucination or as a familial encounter. And you'll notice as we get maybe further into this discussion, the way in which these elements are still there but start to entangle is actually quite useful to the conclusion I eventually make my way to. But for the purposes of this story, they do have a heroic reversal in discovering that it was Ben. It was the Thing this whole time who was opposing them, who wanted them to go back to Earth and quit on this journey to find him. Of course, they do ultimately convince him he should come back from paradise, from heaven. They convince him to come back to Earth. So you do have your liberated character. And I skipped one along the way.
Dreams.
Dreams and hallucinations. Right. So whether the storms are dream or hallucination.
Yeah, so that family
encounter, or familial encounter.
That family encounter happens within a dream in this particular story.
It's hard to say. They leave that open. Either Johnny is imagining, Johnny Storm, the Human Torch, is imagining his paradise wherein his parents are alive and they get to spend time together, or they're actually there, that they're actually encountering the souls of the storms. It's really in the reader's eye, the reader's interpretation, how to take that scene. But if it fills one element, the other, or in a Schrodinger's cat sort of way, both.
Yeah. So in the text that I have, we have this amazing image. Perhaps we can find that for the Religious Studies Project when we do the interview so that readers and listeners can see it, where you have an angel that appears, right? And the angel, because of the way that heaven operates, doesn't speak, right? That's a mortal thing. But this haunting image, it was at Ringo that did the art on that one. Just this utterly haunting image of a faceless angel who's covered in this speech that says kind of scrawlishly, "You don't belong here." Right?
That's right. Like, the speech bubble is his face.
Yeah, is his face.
He communicates through text on his face, flaming text on his face, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I'm just, I'm still kind of haunted by that, which goes back to what you were saying about the way in which the space that is encountered when we're doing heaven is this altered space, totally altered. The semiotics of language don't work as a place. The way that places operate doesn't work the same way. Just really accentuates it. Can you talk a little bit about how the visual elements of that portrayal? Because I think for those who are listening and may not be experienced with comics, I think we have a nice example now of the different kind of six points, but how does the visual element of comics really contribute to those six elements coming forward?
Let me just get through the story part of it. The story explains it. Reed, super genius, explains that we are probably not actually seeing the afterlife. Our brain is just interpreting it as best as we can. And in fact, the landscape will change based on our consciousness. So he gives this explanation that it's actually their perception that creates the landscape, right? So when they do get to Ben, he's no longer the monstrous thing. He's no longer his rocky shaped, superpowered guy. It's normal Ben Grimm. It's the guy from New York. What's curious about this moment is that they interact with human Ben Grimm as they would on Earth. And you could look at that and you could just read it and accept it. They shake hands, they hug, and so forth. But what should be odd to the careful reader is that they transported here. They got here through some super scientific means. They brought their bodies with them into the afterlife. Ben doesn't have his body there, right? He left the monstrous shell of the thing behind. And yet, visually, we're shown their separate sort of entities, their separate stuff being able to engage with each other. Now, I liked looking at that and being able to say, okay, so we are visually accepting these symbols, right? A corpus, a human body, and whatever Ben is now, a soul, a cardia, a nafs, a ruh, to grab from different traditions here, a perfected body. Well, no, his body's not there. That's for later, Paul. Sorry. We are given the visual representation of them being able to engage without an explanation. The reader has to fill in the theological blank here, right? If they give it enough consideration. And I did. I mean, that's why I spent time on this. The conclusion that I came to, at least in terms of this Fantastic Four story, and I think the reason I like this story so much is it's not your typical hell story, right? This is a great place, a lovely place, but it still presents a challenge. I believe I interpreted this depiction, this visual depiction, to be that the internal self or soul, cardia, or psyche is actually on the outside of their physical bodies, their corpus or soma here. And it looks the same. Think of them being encased in their soul the way that they are normally encased in their superhero uniform, right? Clothing and so forth. Whereas Ben, though he has no body to encase himself, is just pure soul stuff now. The reason that they can engage with each other is because they are coded in the correct afterlife material, that they've actually sort of absorbed their bodies into the visual representation of their soul or essence and so forth. Now, visually, they sell characters to us, but we can go back to Reed's explanation, right? Things are going to be interpreted the way that you choose to perceive them. But if we follow this strange afterlife logic that they can engage each other, then these visual symbols take on this additional meaning.
So let's go through that carefully again. The Skype call may have cut out just a tidbit. I want to make sure that we get it really clearly. So we have the physical bodies of the Fantastic Four and Mr. Fantastic with the three, of course, the fourth being Ben, who is potentially in heaven with his perfected body or maybe just his soul. So so we have Mr. Fantastic and he's projecting the souls with the body essences into heaven. Can you say that one more time for me?
I'll try summarizing that again. Since the three living members of the Fantastic Four seem to be able to physically engage with their deceased member, their fourth member, who doesn't have a body available, doesn't have a soma or a corpus available to him, you're left to ask, well, what are they interacting with? How are they interacting? What is the material? What is the ether?
So just to be clear, it's in the comic, the visual representation of Ben is the same in heaven as the visual representation of the Fantastic Four that are alive and not dead and coming to visit him in heaven. And that sameness in the depiction of all four of the characters in heaven creates a situation where we have to wonder what is the difference between the projections that are being put into heaven versus Ben, who appears to be in heaven. So how can we explain the kind of synchronicity of visual forms when we display all four of them in heaven at the same time?
And the rest of the story bears this out. After they convince Ben that he should be back, that it wasn't his time, and a few other plot details take place, they are granted an audience with what seems to be God, with an entity that they recognize to be God, but he looks like an old Jewish man like Jack Kirby, the artist, along with Stan Lee, who created the Fantastic Four. And he explains that he is not insulted by this perception, that he actually finds it flattering, that his creations imagine him and see him as relatable, see him as approachable, and so forth. But this does underscore the idea that what we're getting visually in the comic is just symbol, is just representation. And in fact, comics are the perfect medium in which to recognize that, right? When we watch film, they try to make us forget most often that we're actually watching a film. They try to make it immersive, and 3D does that even more so, right? Yep. Same with television. And even music is not trying to remind you that you're listening to a recording. They try to make the music sound as authentic, in many cases, as if the instruments were in the room with you. Not so with comics. Comics always remind you that what you're getting is art. What you're getting is symbols. What you're getting is abstractions and representations. And in doing that, in not hiding behind any visual realism, but actually foregrounding this strength of it, frankly, that this is all representation, we can engage in stories about the afterlife or about other spiritual planes or what have you without having to claim they're real. Just getting to enjoy the interplay and then interpret and decipher it theologically for ourselves.
Yeah, I think you're right on point with the way in which comics seem to accept their media much more than some of the other art forms that just want to break right out of their media and try to be everything but what they are. So
this may be one of the, I think one of the watershed moments or the public watershed moment of this was Art Spiegelman's Mouse.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think one of the reasons it was recognized is that, of course, they're not mice.
Yeah.
Of course, they're not cats. Spiegelman realizes that. Spiegelman wants you to realize that. Spiegelman wants you to fall into the trap of seeing all Nazis as the same and thus all cats, and all Jews as the same and thus all mice. It's that representationality that comics cannot escape and therefore embraces that makes stories like superheroes going into the afterlife that valuable.
Yeah, and I think the example that you use in your book to really kind of demonstrate that is Scott McCloud, who has in his famous work Understanding Comics, he has this scene where he shows Rene Magritte's "This Is Not a Pipe,"
right.
and he's like, "This is not a pipe. Well, it's not even a painting of a pipe. This is a cartoon of a painting that is also not a pipe," right? So we have these
and he
layers.
Keeps going forward. He keeps he's saying this is a reproduction of a cartoon of a painting of a pipe. And if we didn't get the rights to include it in our light book, unfortunately, but it's such a well-known image. Yeah. It can be found on the internet everywhere. Maybe even the podcast will link to it.
Yeah.
Once it gets to you, it's further abstracted, right? Yeah. This is a screen grab of a scan of a reproduction of a cartoon yeah. of a painting of a pipe.
Yeah, and all the, and all those layers, I think, really deconstruct our ability to treat it as something that is not symbolic or not representational, or that the creators did not somehow really, really think about the fact that this was going to be on a page held by someone who was recognizing that it's on a page with gutters, and that they, you know, have to consider the different ways that they read it across vertically. Do we start at the beginning? Am I coming in the middle of the story? Right. And all of those things that readers have to do to really kind of like make up the pieces of the story. Right. The writers are seem to be embracing them right actively and promoting
and
them
this
in
is,
the narrative.
And not only with these superhero afterlife stories, which is the focus of this book, but for my, my research in general, my research at large. This is why comics seem so vital, so valuable to religious studies. Because if they present a god, if they present, let's say, a Yahweh, a godhead or a divinity, at no point is the comic book saying, you must take this as the real god, right? They can engage in these ideas, both visually and textually, from a safe distance. That's not to say we shouldn't take comic books seriously. That's not to say that the stories they tell can't be realistic, but the medium itself allows for a verisimilitude, an understood verisimilitude, where there is, I feel, less being threatened, that you will not accidentally start worshiping the comic book or the graphic novel or the trade paperback or what have you. You will not take it to be a religious icon or avatar, even if it claims to be a picture of, let's say, Vishnu.
Yeah.
Or we use as a character Thor in particular, very popular in comics. This is what one of the things that makes comics so exciting for religious studies. And we could get into David Morgan's discussion of visual culture and visual religious culture. But here is where comics differentiates itself from film, television, painted art, sculpture, architecture. It never claims to be the thing itself, only the idea of the thing in a very, you know, semiotic, Saussurean move.
But
that's what makes it intriguing to me.
Well, it's always playing the game of if you see the Buddha, kill the Buddha. Right?
Very good. Yes, like that's right.
It's always playing that game of, well, but not really.
Right. No, the medium is based on that. And I am not disparaging the medium at all. I love comic books and I love writing and I love reading them. But it's great that its artificiality is worn on its sleeve, that it has, I think, what Will Eisner, comic book legend, calls the special reality of comics.
Yeah.
It never claims to be the real, but it might claim to be the true.
So let's bring it back to one of the other points that I think I was really impressed with in your recent work, and that's the way in which comics have this kind of multiplicity of identities that are created when we interact with spaces of the afterlife, and the way in which it deconstructs our notion of a singular self, which I'm doing a unit in Buddhism right now in my class. Like I couldn't help but make all of those kind of deeply Buddhist connections. But this seems to be a pervasive interaction between the representations of self that we're getting and the kind of work that needs to be done to represent those selves in the afterlife. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, there are a few ways into this, and really the whole book is me teasing my way into this larger idea. But I think it comes down to this. At least since the time of Augustine, of St. Augustine, at least the popular Judeo-Christian and even Islamic concept of the self was a united self, right? A whole self. A fractured self is either someone who is ill, like mentally unstable, or unlike God, God is one. God is whole. The Trinity is a whole for Christians. Yahweh is whole for Jews. And, of course, the unicity of God, of Allah, for Muslims is paramount. Okay. Eastern traditions challenge that a little bit. And more, what we loosely call Western traditions that I just mentioned, are beginning to see that one can operate it as a multiple self, as a multiplex self, and still be a functional and soulful human. How do comics contribute to this? How does depictions of superheroes in the afterlife contribute to this? Well, the first thing I'll say is that even before we get to characters in the afterlife, we have the Scott McCloud Magritte painting again. That is to say, you open the page, there's six panels. Each one has a picture of Scott McCloud in it. We read it as just a sequence of events, like a film unspooling, that we move from one to the next and it's the same character. But if we actually took a step back, we'd see that there are six versions of him on the page to communicate some meaning, some message. And you can do that with any comic book. You don't need to specifically take it into the afterlife. However, as I got further into these studies of superheroes in the afterlife, superheroes being almost necessarily multiple to begin with, whether they have secret identities or not, whether they are written by different writers and therefore come across as slightly different characters, depending on what book you're reading at the time. When the six elements I mentioned before are pushed to their utmost, I think I alluded earlier to the Fantastic Four having two elements that started to overlap with each other. Are the storms a hallucination or are they a familial encounter? Well, if you read enough of these afterlife comics, you'll notice that a lot of these elements start to get sticky. They start to have the heroic reversal come from the liberated character. Or the liberated character is hallucinated to have been liberated. Is that as good as being liberated, et cetera, et cetera. The ultimate result that I come to in one of my later chapters is that you start to find that these elements require almost conspicuously the sense of a unified self. They seem to be addicted to the sense of a unified self, that if you were to let that go, if one was to accept or just embrace the idea that people are constructed by multiple selves, and this we can find in many religious traditions, the Ka and the Po, or the
Atman.
Hold on, I'm blanking on it. Sorry. Or the Atman. Yes, yeah. Thank you. Whether we look at Egyptian religious tradition, whether we look at Buddhist religious tradition, whether we look at Eastern religious tradition of China and such, we find that we can have a whole new understanding of what these stories are trying to communicate. They're actually, through these six elements that are straining to keep us unified, to keep souls unified, to keep selves unified. Actually, if we see them as symptoms of the strain, then we can say, well, why are we operating under that strain to begin with? Wouldn't these stories be either more easily, more usefully, more enlighteningly read if we see these characters as multiplex? The reason many people don't is because we don't want to see ourselves as multiple. Because I think a lot of us in Western tradition in the United States have been trained to see ourselves as whole individuals. Now, there is unhealthy multiplicity, certainly, but there's also healthy multiplicity. And what results from healthy multiplicity, this comes from the work of Helene Talon Russell. This also comes from the literary theory work of J. Hillis Miller. If you look at multiplicity as healthy, then it promotes religious pluralism. It does that by, if you acknowledge in yourself that there is an other, that there are many others or elements of other in yourself, then you have a much harder time of seeing people you encounter as other, as necessarily alienating them, as necessarily different. If we accept the differences in ourselves, we can more easily accept difference between others and between faiths. I think this is a healthy, useful, fun way to read these superhero afterlife stories, that they are the last, they are pushing against the last bulwark, these six elements that are straining to hold together only a unified whole self. So I've said that a few different ways. Maybe I can clarify.
I think that was quite clear. I think that the conflict that we see, between the hold that a singular self has on us occurs in many places, even outside comic books. The thing that occurred to me while I was reading was when Facebook first emerged. I'm probably one of the first people that, you know, in my generation who really had a lot of access to it. Duke University, where I was an undergraduate, was among the first schools outside of the Massachusetts area that was invited in with its college students. And so when we all started to join, the question became very quickly, when they expanded the members of Facebook to include people beyond college email addresses, that the question became, who am I on Facebook? I'm no longer in college, but the college network is the network I have on Facebook. Now all of my non-college friends are on Facebook. Am I still that collegiate undergraduate? Am I now somehow this person that is an alum and who's an alumni network? Now when you have like a whole new generation of people coming on, am I just the professor who's on who's on Facebook? Am I friending my students? Is it?
And now you're getting into the discussion I have over Digital Death in the other book that I co-edited, how identity is being complicated even posthumously in our digital age. The only thing I would add to that is I'd like to argue that this was happening even before the computer age. Even before the computer age, and this goes into the literary theory work of, I think, Alex Wallach. Definitely his last name's Wallach. The idea that we were always constructing ourselves in the same way that we construct characters. We were always putting together bits and pieces to identify what we want to call a whole, W-H-O-L-E, even if it wasn't actually a whole. You're absolutely right, though. Social media and online telepresence has brought it to the forefront, has made it clearer that we operate as a self in different ways, constituting in ourselves selves, plural. Yeah. So I think that if we can embrace that without seeing it as being a contradiction, we're not saying, hey, you're wrong to see yourself as whole, but could you also see yourself as multiple? Could you also see yourself as being a construction of different elements in the same way that a genre is a construction of elements? So are we, so are communities, and so are audiences. This ultimately to the goal of not only healthier self-understanding, but also, as I said before, more engaged religious pluralism. We can't reject the other as easily.
Yeah, no, I think that point about the way in which it can really influence pluralism is so poignant too, given that so many of the comics that are coming out right now in the United States are so focused on religious elements. I know that we've been talking elsewhere about East of West, which is about the kind of Book of Revelation and the apocalypse, and the four horsemen of the apocalypse are running around on this kind of futuristic version of Earth. But there's also just it seems to be this kind of glory moment for the intersection of religion and comic books, where the gods are literally coming back to life and the immortals are walking again.
I'd actually like to echo that. I'll add to that. We both have a multitude of comics, mainstream secular comics dealing with religious elements. You're absolutely right. And that's what Sacred and Sequential is all about. The group of scholars, the whole team of scholars working on religion and comics. But I also want to add that just the idea of existential crisis is coming across in particularly superhero comics more than ever before. They are dealing with issues of what is reality, what is the true me, what is greater meaning, even if they don't invoke specifically religious language. We have DC with its coming convergence super event, and we have Marvel Comics with its time runs out super event. I think that this is really, I think the reason this is coming to the fore is because of the communities to which these comics are being sold, to the audiences. And it's an expanding audience now. It's growing for the first time in maybe decades.
And we should really note for all the readers who think that this is going to go away, it's not. And it's not going to go away because the lineup for the next 10 years of comic book movies has just been released. So in 2015, we're going to have Avengers, another movie in the Avengers series, along with Ant-Man, a very classic superhero, and another Fantastic Four movie. In 2016, we get Deadpool, another Batman and Superman crossover now, where Batman is going to be fighting against Superman. We're going to have another Captain America movie, an X-Men movie, a new franchise, Suicide Squad, that's a very kind of famous indie comic. We're going to get Doctor Strange and the Sinister Six. In 2017,
there's a lot coming, but I think the point that, and I have actually a theory about the movies that are coming up, but maybe that's off the beaten path. The point I want to make is at one point, it was Joseph Campbell's monomyth where the hero figuratively died and came back that was the chief proponent of these stories and of many different genre stories, the Western, the sci-fi, and so forth. Now that's becoming literal in superhero comics because it is such a pressing concern, because the trope is now so quickly recognized and comics are recognized as representational. Why not have the representational hero do the literal dying and the literal resurrecting? I think it's being done now in a way that we don't have to immediately link to Christological concerns, immediately link to Jesus and soteriology. You can have an anti-hero like cosmic badass Lobo, who rides around on a cosmic motorcycle, come back from the dead without having to see him as a Jesus character, right? So it's gone from the figurative to the literal. I think that's going to happen in the films as well. And if we look really carefully at the titles that have been announced by at least Marvel Comics, they've announced a Captain America sequel called Civil War, a Thor sequel called Ragnarok, and then a two-part Avengers sequels called The Infinity War.
Yep.
If they are at all like their comic book storylines, if they don't deviate terribly from what was in comics, these storylines involve the death of certain heroes. Civil War ends with, this is spoiler alert, ends with Captain America's death.
Yep.
Ragnarok ends with Thor's death.
Yep.
Infinity War ends with a number of characters' death, but guess what? They all come back. They all go through this afterlife experience one way or the other to communicate, I argue, that we have to understand these characters and audiences' selfhood differently than we once did.
So I think you heard it here first. Number one, spoilers. your favorite superheroes are likely on the chop block in their upcoming movies. But on the other hand, I think
to the degree that they can be chopped.
Yeah, only the point that they can be chopped. So let's end on those kind of two points and draw it to a close here. So number one, I think there has never been as significant a time, both in the production of physical comics, but also in the media possibilities that the comic genre is offering to wider and wider audiences right now.
I absolutely agree with that point, and I just want to emphasize it goes beyond the superhero.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? It's written in the DNA of the medium, and we have a number of great works coming out, either autobiographical or in different genres like noir or romance, where religion is a key factor and worthy of study, either as an artifact of culture, artifact of our given culture of the time, artifact of what sells at the moment, or just in terms of the actual construction. What are these stories communicating, and how is the visual being used in them? So you're absolutely seeing it in the superhero, Dave. I can't argue with that at all, but I don't want to limit it there either.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And my own shelf betrays my reluctance to go too deeply into the superhero good world. I like the non-superheroes. So good. so we have this moment, and just wanna, I think we both want to make a pitch that if these things, the afterlife, especially if the elements of comic books and the ways in which they really are tugging at the representations of the self, this is the time to get into it right now, because the next 5 years of major movie releases, summer blockbusters that we're going to have worldwide release for the next 5 years, are going to put these things, we are going to be saturated for the next 5 years by these storylines and these characters. And there has never been as ripe a time to kind of really jump right in and really up the game of scholarship to really include things like literary theory and like representational theory and like theories of consciousness and self. This is the time to like make those crossover events.
And homiletics and hermeneutics. And I mean, come up with as many fancy words as you want. You can point to what's being delivered to the popular masses, these great mythological stories being delivered on big screens nationwide, and tease out of them exciting scholarly and theoretical and theological insights. One last one that I'll offer, you can cut it if there isn't time, is one of the things that I delight in about the comic book, regardless of the genre, is how it is both sequential, chronological, at the same time that it is eternal and static. You can look at a page flat, like God looking down at all existence and all time, or you can enter mortal time and play things out in order. I like to read comics, and this is a term that I think Frank Kermode offered. I like to read the genre, not the genre, I like to read the medium as operating in AEVUM, AEVUM, the idea that we can move in and out of eternal time and chronological time simply because of the way that this medium is constructed. I can't think of another medium that does this. Perhaps high visual art, triptychs, and so forth might be able to communicate a similar sense, but you have this in every single comic, from the silliest to the absolute most mature and sophisticated. So that's just one more pitch for ways in which comics and religious studies are natural bedfellows.
Excellent. You want to live forever? Read a comic book, right?
Or be in one.
Or be in one. Yeah, there you go. So it has been a great pleasure to talk to you, A. Dave Lewis. And we cannot wait to read whatever is next on the block for you. And thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So, David, that was Dave and A. David. Interesting stuff. We were just discussing there before we started recording this whole, the way in which superheroes are, particularly now we can all relate to the new Marvel incarnations that are coming out, resurrecting old ideas, superheroes literally being resurrected, the place that afterlives play in this. I immediately think of Thor, of course, where you have this interplay of it is a world of deities, but they're also not deities because it's a world and things like that.
Yeah, it's a good example, and one which I referenced specifically in my response, which will be published on Thursday. But we shouldn't make the mistake of conflating comic books with superheroes.
Of course.
But I do think it's fair to, you know, to point out that a lot, there is a, you know, a major conflation of them. And perhaps the reason that superheroes, if we accept the critique that superheroes are a space age mythology or, you know, a modern American kind of mythology, that therefore the, particular ability and suitability of the comic form to talking about other worlds, afterlives, parallel realities, of mixing up our perception of time and of levels of being, particularly then suits the mythological character of superheroes.
Yeah, and there's a lot of ways that you can go with that thinking. And so we're very much looking forward to seeing a response piece from you. I've only written one response. I think this might be your third. Yeah. You wrote a response to Bruno Latour.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if there was one before that.
There might have been one. I can't remember. But definitely, anyway, you're just about to edge ahead of me in the response writing category. Do we have some news for you? We had another person get in touch with us this week. The most common, if not only, complaint that we receive at the Religious Studies Project concerns the quality of our audio recording, which we will hold up our hands and say, you know, is variable. And this is not to do with David, Dan, or Cole, who have been doing our audio editing. It is largely due to the circumstances the interviews are recorded in, that podcast intros are recorded in, and the equipment that we record on. So, of course, we can always go, hey, we're giving you this for free, take it or leave it. But we are aware that we want to address this. If we had lots of money, we could probably address it more. So remember those Amazon links, people. And if you have any sort of spare sponsorship money lying around, we'd be delighted to hear from you. But one thing we're going to try, to get a hold of some more clip-on individual mics rather than using the microphone on the recorder that we normally use. We're going to try that. So listen out for that change, hopefully. Over the coming weeks, if we can move forward on that.
But, I mean, it is, there are so many reasons that can affect the audio. I mean, one very simple, example is that, you know, obviously I've had training in how to do audio in the past, but most people haven't and are unaware of the different kind of mic settings and what they can, set up and what, you know, what kind of sounds carry and what can be edited, for instance. But say they give us a really interesting interview which has sound issues, what would you do? Would you reject that interview that might be of use to some students, you know, that's got some really interesting, unique data or, you know, really interesting take on the subject because the audio is not quite up to scratch? We've been in that situation, and on every occasion we've erred on the fact of, well, you know, the sound's not quite what it should be this week, but we think this is good data. But there's also the practicalities of publishing week to week.
Yeah.
Sometimes it comes down to, do you want to put something out that where the audio is substandard, or do you want to miss a week?
Yeah. And, you know, but we are very aware that we would like to be putting out the best product that we could be. And, you know, one thing that we have done is produce interview guide for ourselves and for all our interviewers, which does focus particularly upon things that people can do in the moment of recording an interview to try and make the recording as good as possible. So looking for locations with minimal background noise, checking levels, stuff which might sound quite basic, but which in the heat of the moment, I know I've been guilty of. Just, you know, sometimes you're really push for time.
Yeah, yeah, and it's often a compromise. Yeah, so. It's, you know, can I cope with a little bit of background noise, or does this interview just not happen?
Yeah.
Sometimes I've seen our interviews take place, you know, with literally the person's taxi waiting outside. There is no more time to to play with the sound. You have to go. And that's the reality. And you know, it's taken us, what are we, this is the fourth year?
Yeah.
Of regular podcasts, and it's taken us till now to be in a financial situation where we can even afford to be talking about buying new mics.
And to have enough editorial free time on our part to try and work out how to go about it. It's an ongoing issue, and we do appreciate that it can sometimes be difficult to listen to and not ideal, but hopefully.
We're in terra incognita. This isn't something that we can borrow how this works off previously existing organizations and ways of doing it. The ways of doing it don't exist. So we are, you know, to some degree improvising. Yeah. But I would repeat the call. If you appreciate what we do, try and help us out, you know, use our Amazon links. If you've got lots of spare money, pop it in an envelope and send it to us. We will use every penny for making the podcasts clearer and better.
Up until now, we haven't run a sort of charity donation appeal that you will find on some podcasts. And it is something that we might consider doing in the future. But at the same time, we don't want to guilt you, because we aren't making money out of this, but we also aren't selling it. We want it to be free. We don't want people to feel that they have to donate, but equally, we're doing it on quite limited funds.
Yes, and these are real limitations. That being said, if you have a constructive suggestion as to how we can raise some money, I mean, we would like to hear how you would like to support us. We thought the Amazon way of doing it was a good way, and it seems in Britain at least it's working, but not so much in the US. But, you know, is there another way that you could support us? Would you like a button that you could click on the website and donate $5 or 20 euros or however much? Or would you prefer if there was some sort of subscription model there that the institutions, for instance, if you're using us in teaching, would you be prepared to go down that route and donate a certain amount of money in the equivalent of the way that a department would subscribe to a journal, for instance? Would that be the kind of thing that would work? Anyway, I mean, we don't know. That's kind of why I'm asking.
Well, we've been talking on here, so we'll maybe just leave that with you. But essentially, we're always interested and welcoming to hear any suggestions, any compliments or criticism. So, but the audio issue is something that's, you know, close to our consciousness. So that's just that. But remember Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, Google+, the BSR, fantastic. And if you've managed to last to this point,
thanks for listening.